Welcome to the Advocacy Podcast, Journeys to Excellence. We speak with Queen's Counsel, trial lawyers and judges from around the world about how they excel in the courtroom. Please subscribe on your favourite podcast platform and visit us for additional resources at theadvocacypodcast.com.
I'm your host, Bibi Badejo, and today's episode offers a dual exploration of analytic rigour. We'll hear from the Honourable Justice Anne Ainslie Wallace, a beacon in the field of case analysis, on how to do it properly. Then from the expert on experts, Ian Robertson SC, who will enlighten us on the analytical process he uses in complex cases with competing or challenging expert opinions. What are the new sorts of techniques that are used within the programs that you run, say, for example, trial advocacy?
What we have in the last few years done is we spend much more time talking about case theory. Case theory has always been an important part of training in any sort of structured training sense. But there were two changes that we've made in the last few years. The first is, it's not enough to talk to people about case theory. You must have one. You can't really prepare properly unless you have one. But my own experience, and I suspect the experience of many advocates, is how do you know a case theory when you see it? How do you know if your case theory is good? Used to be people would say, oh, you'll know it when you see it, which isn't terribly helpful. So we've developed a session that we do as in the introductory session, is not only talking about what a case theory is, but we do a small exercise where we develop a case theory with the group of participants who are there. We divide the room in half prosecution, half defence, and through argument between us all, we develop a case theory for that particular little exercise. In my view, that has been so helpful in assisting advocates to understand what it does look like when you get it. And we focus much more now on the development of case theory, because I think it's widely accepted in advocacy circles that cases are lost with an inadequately thought out case theory. They're rarely lost by the occasional dud question in evidence in chief, or the occasional non-leading question in cross-examination. Many cases are lost because people haven't thought through the case theory completely, or heaven forbid, at all. So that's where our focus is. And in fact, last year, we ran a discrete case analysis workshop where the focus of the workshop was the development of a case theory, its implementation in cross-examination, and then a discussion. And we did that with two case theories over a day.
That's excellent, because as you were saying, being able to develop a case theory as a group probably highlights so much to other people that they've never even thought about.
Of course it does.
And when I think of how I train, and I have been trained, there's so much focus on the witness handling, the examination in chief, cross-examination, closing speeches. You can see where you've gone wrong, but you're kind of left to go and deal with the case theory by yourself. You don't even talk about it with the participants. So the foundation, it seems to me, can sometimes be shaky because no one's talked to you about that. So that's really an amazing...
Correct. And I think also you get to a point in your advocacy when you're a bit embarrassed to say, look, I don't know what a case theory is, or I don't know how to achieve one, or I don't know what it looks like when I have one. And there are as many ways of developing a case theory as there are types of advocates. But I think if in a group, which is far less confrontational than one-on-one, if participants have a chance to throw ideas around, suggest arguments that might be made on the evidence, and then have the other side say, well, you might say that, but we're going to say this, really get an idea of how the case theory works with the evidence, And in that same workshop, we then take the case theory and turn it into the submissions, the closing argument. Because the real foundation of good advocacy is a good detailed case theory that has translated to your closing argument.
What mistakes do you see that other barristers make when they come before you?
Talking about first instance work, I think the thing that I see most often is a lack of clarity about the case theory, where they're going. An ideal case theory is one that informs your submissions informs your evidence. But I think too many people don't look back at the case theory and say, do I need all of this? Are all of these points good? Which are my best points? Which are my weakest points? Can I lose the weak points and still maintain the strength of the good points? And so what you see is a cross-examination that makes some good points and then drifts off into weak points, silly points. I think they have the effect of draining the power from the good points. And if I could teach everybody that one thing, once you've got your case theory, once you have your submissions, you need to say, do I need to say all of that? Are they all equally good? I like to think of it as the barristers being distracted by something shiny. Oh, here's something that might be good to submit on. Oh, there's something else.
When you get written submissions or briefs, as our American counterparts call them, what are you looking for?
I'm looking for clarity. I want to understand what the appeal challenges are. In a written submission, I want an explanation. The judge erred in failing to take into account this evidence. It's material because, and so on. That's in the written argument. And later on, I see you want to talk about the difference between the written argument and the oral argument. But what we look at as appeal judges is how the argument is developed in the written grounds so that we can start preparing, we can read ahead, we can look at the cases so that when we start the appeal, we're mostly against the same background of authority. And written submissions that don't expose the argument just make the job harder.
So what do you think the key is to having a comprehensive document that contains all the key issues and provides clarity, but is still concise? Because I know that you will not appreciate a 100-page document when 15 or 20 pages could do.
Well, we have page limits.
Oh, great.
We have a 15-page limit, which, of course, drives people to be concise. But what I look for is, as I say, an exposure of the grounds. This is the error. This evidence wasn't taken into account. It was important because, etc. Bit like you would make in a closing argument in a trial. You need to expose the point. And it's in the written argument that you can outline the authorities. If you feel you need to quote from a bit of the authority, you can put it in there. Because when you come to make the oral argument, it's something different.
Is there anything in particular that you find persuasive? Because obviously a narrative of the facts and there's no analysis doesn't help. But what do you find persuasive in the written argument?
I think an understanding that what you're saying to the judge is this. This is the ground. This is how that error fits into the overall case. This is why we say it's an error. These are the authorities. What we often get is a long exposition of the background facts, a long exposition about what the trial judge found, and very little about the ground and the particulars. For my point, what is persuasive in a written argument is getting to the point without the blather, without the background, without the traipsing through the trial judge's reasons, because we've read them. I think the answer to good advocacy at any level is to understand what interests the listener. And the great failure of some advocates is that they make the points they're interested in. They spend their time on arguments they're interested in, and they never think, if I was the judge, what point is going to trouble me most? What point is going to interest me most? So if you start thinking about the listener, the judge or the judges or the jury, then you start to anticipate the sorts of things that they might be concerned about. And if I can give you a little example from my time in the criminal court, I was hearing sentences one day, and a really good advocate, I read the papers and he stood up and he said, "I know what's troubling you." And I thought to myself, "I bet you don't." And he did. And he knew it because he'd thought about it. When he had read the documents, he thought, what would bother a sentencing judge most about these facts? And he addressed those. And he addressed the thing that I was bothered about really comprehensively. Now, that did two things. It immediately addressed my concerns, so I wasn't, if you like, thinking about that while he was making other submissions. He was interested in meeting my needs, and I was interested in listening to how he was going to do that. And it was a lovely piece of advocacy, and that's what all advocates should strive for.
So turning to the advocates' preparation itself, because obviously as a lawyer we need to prepare before we even start speaking to the expert, and as you were saying, instructing the expert and looking at what they're going to be exploring. Where do you start in that process?
I think I'd start reading from the report. So I'll read their report thoroughly. If it's a responding report, I'll obviously have to read the other report first to come to some kind of landing about where it is and form a preliminary view about the areas I think are in dispute. Mostly nowadays, by the time I'm doing that, there's a joint expert report which actually identifies where they are at odds. So that's not a hard exercise to do. After I've looked at the joint expert report and done formed a view about it, I will start the formal analysis part of my preparation for the report. And I would normally, before, you know, the formal side of the analysis, resort to Dr. Google, etc., to find out the jargon stuff that I perhaps don't know, to give you an idea. I've just had a case dealing with a colorectal surgeon and a resection that went terribly wrong. 90% of the terms that were being used were completely foreign to me, so I had to get online and dig all that out. Now, the beauty of it is that when I started practice in 1986, I had to go to Gray's Anatomy or some other text which explained a medical term with another medical term and made it really hard to follow. Now you can get online and find all this stuff available, written for lay people and sometimes with YouTube stuff, so you can watch the operation being done and, you know, all sorts of things that just did not exist once upon a time, or certainly weren't available to us once upon a time. So I would do all of that before I start the formal dissection of the report, and then I would move to the formal dissection of the report in the way that we talked about in Melbourne.
When you get to the formal analysis, what's the process that you undergo?
I tend to analyze it by kind of critical path. So I think I talked to you in Melbourne about a app you can get for Android or Apple, which is called Simple Mind, which is a mapping tool, the kind of thing that you would use for, say, a flow chart to map a corporate structure or to map a family tree, which is how I came across it to start with. I build into that tool the logic of the expert report. So let's say the joint report of the two experts says an issue in the case is whether the anesthesia should have been used at all at that time or whether there was a danger that would cause brain injury. So that's the issue, is should the anesthesia be used at all? And then to work out the competing views about that, I box it up. So this is the first step, this is the second step in the logic, getting to the conclusion. So I tend to start with the conclusion. So this is his conclusion in paragraph 20.6 of the report, and then work backwards from the conclusion, backfilling the boxes to get the flow of the logic to get to the starting point. And then when I've got to the starting point, I come back through the logic to make sure I've got the logic right. So I get from the major premise to the conclusion, and I fully understand where that logic is. And then I do the same thing with the other side's opposite conclusion about that central issue. And when you do it that way, you'll find pretty readily that the box that they don't agree on is one box. It's not 10 boxes. So you don't have to attack this expert about 10 different things. You only have to establish one thing, because there's only one box in the logic tree that requires you to overturn it. And once you do that, you've overturned the opinion. So it's a very formal way that I do it. Some people are smart enough to do it intuitively without having to do it in that kind of long form. I'm not that smart, so I tend to like to see it written down either on paper or on the screen.
I think I can also put my hand up and say I'm definitely not that smart to do it in that way. And I remember you talking about the logical fallacy and putting forward very simple premises. For example, all men are mortal. Homer is a man, therefore Homer is mortal, or something like that. So is that the sort of thing, and I've really simplified it to three sentences here, but is that the sort of thing that one would be looking at if you're looking at the expert's conclusion, which is conclusion is X, these are the premises that are being relied on, and then exploring whether or not they're actually true, or perhaps mistaken, or even, I'll go so far as to say, a fallacy. What do you think?
It's old. I mean, the Greeks have been doing this for thousands of years. It's an old syllogistic approach to analysis. Major premise, minor premise leads to a conclusion. And if you take the one that you just postulated, which is classic Plato, it's easy to see. So, you know, the other one that people often use is all horses are black. Acorn is a horse. Acorn is black. If you think about it that way, and if you can reduce the opinion in that way, some can be, some can't be, some require more parts to the major and the minor premise, they're pretty easy to pull apart the opinions then, pull apart in the sense of understand their opinions. And then you can decide whether you want to attack the major premise or you want to attack the minor premise, and what the consequence of you succeeding with your attack on the major premise is, and what the consequence of you succeeding in attack on the minor premise is, and makes the cross-examination so much easier because you're not fighting with the expert about everything.
Do you want to become a better advocate, but you don't have the time to attend long in-person training courses? If so, the Advocacy Coach Members Club is the perfect solution for you. Our members-only club gives you access to concise, advanced advocacy courses that you can learn at your own pace on your own time. You'll also get exclusive access to replays of the Advocacy Clinic, our online platform for lawyers to practice their advocacy skills, and a private members-only podcast. In addition, you'll become part of a community of like-minded lawyers who are all committed to becoming better advocates. You'll have the opportunity to network with other members, share ideas, and get feedback on your work. Join the Advocacy Coach Members Club today and start becoming a better advocate on your own time. To find out more and join, go to theadvocacycoach.com/members club. Become unstoppable at court with the Advocacy Coach, your partner in your journey to advocacy excellence.
Thank you for listening to the Advocacy Podcast, Journeys to Excellence. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe and visit us at theadvocacypodcast.com for reading lists and other resources. Until next time.